We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be taking a look at the process that the government uses to try to determine the safety and effectiveness of prescription drugs, both before they're released to the general public and also after. One thing certainly we know is that there are a lot of Americans that take prescription medicines. In fact, according to a fairly recent survey conducted by the folks at Consumer Reports, they found that nearly half of all Americans take at least one prescription drug on a regular basis. And when they asked the people in their survey what their concerns were, a couple of things came up, and there really should not be a surprise. One thing that people said they were very concerned about was the cost of medication. Another thing they said they were concerned about was safety, and their feeling that they simply weren't getting the information that they needed to have about the safety of the medicines that they were taking. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Frank Palumbo. He is professor and executive director of the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy Center on Drugs and Public Policy. He's also a member of the Maryland Bar and is both a licensed pharmacist and has practiced pharmacy and law. He's done a lot of writing and research in this particular area. He's been good enough to give us some of his time this morning, and we welcome questions. Now, we hope that people will indeed, when they call in, keep their questions brief and keep them focused on the topic. That way we can get as many callers in as possible. And certainly questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You may also send along your comments to our email site, which is will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Palumbo, hello.
Oh, good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Well, thanks very much for giving us your time. We certainly appreciate it. Maybe a place to start, I don't know if this is too big a question, but certainly when you read the results of a survey like this that I mentioned, or you look at the papers and the television and see what's reported about drugs, you certainly see reasons to be concerned. And there are cases, for example, one that got a lot of attention was the case of the drug Vioxx, which was found. It was a widely used drug, and it seemed to be a good one, had good benefits, and yet had problems associated with it. Just more recently, another example you might point to is the case of the drug Avandia, which is taken by people with diabetes. And there was concerns about whether or not it increased people's risk of heart attack and whether or not that drug should be used or not. And all of that, I think, it starts to add up after a while. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who are wondering, well, what is the government doing here? Is the FDA really doing its job to make sure that the medicines that we all take are safe?
Well, that's a very good question, David. And I think I'd like to answer it by first pointing out what I think a lot of people think about medicines that are approved by the Food and Drug Administration. I believe that a lot of people think that if the government has approved something, that it's absolutely safe for me to go ahead and take it, that there won't be any problems because the government has said, you know, we have put our blessing on this. And the fact of the matter is that when FDA approves a drug for the market, it does what's called a benefit-to-risk assessment. Now, they're not really numbers, but they're just they look at the benefit and then they look at the risk. And they make a judgment based on the clinical trials and the effectiveness of the drug versus perhaps a placebo or no drug or compared to other drugs. And they then look at the risk information or the safety information that they have on it to date, and they make a judgment as to whether this drug is both safe and effective. Of course, if they know that people are going to die from the drug, the odds are that they're not going to approve it. But oftentimes, they don't know that. And if you look at some of the examples of drugs that have come off the market, they are drugs that had been out on the market for quite some time and have had amassed a history of use over that time. When the manufacturers or sponsors, sometimes NIH sponsors something, do clinical trials to determine whether a drug can be is safe and effective and can be marketed. They may have upwards of a total of 3,000 patients that they've studied that drug on in the phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 trials, phase 3 being the largest. And when you think about it, if a serious event is going to happen in, for example, in every 10,000 patients, it might not get picked up in the clinical trials. And then afterwards, it's even a little more difficult to figure out whether an adverse event is associated with a drug, because no longer do you have people in these trials that are well controlled and they're watched over time, and they know what other illnesses they might have had. They have regular exams and so forth. So it's a lot more difficult to try to really look at the picture. So what we see is that it's much later when the FDA finally says, well, we're convinced now that this problem is related to the use of this drug.
Yeah.
And that's what happens.
And that's something that I imagine, if people think about it, will find it's a reality, but it's something that they will find disturbing. That is the idea that by the time that you finish up your clinical trials and then you release a medication to the general public, that only a few thousand people have taken it, and that really to know the full effect of the drug, both its full potential and its downside, you have to wait until more people take it. So that, in a sense, that really means that once a drug is released to the general public for at least, you know, who knows, maybe a period of a few years, mm-hmm. you might actually have to say that this is still an experimental drug.
Well, in many ways, that's absolutely true, because there's so much you don't know about it. After it goes on the market, you start to amass more information. And you think about some of these blockbuster drugs that are out there. They're studied in several thousand patients. They hit the market, and within a year, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have taken them. And so once it gets through that FDA gate, the number of people who take these things goes up dramatically. And there are so many more exposures. And FDA tries to make sure that the clinical trials are structured in such a way that big problems are not going to occur. But there are no guarantees. And you're right. You know, people are taking new drugs, and occasionally they've only been tested on a few thousand patients before person X takes the drug. I've heard people who are influential in pharmaceuticals say, I wouldn't give anybody in my family a drug until it's been on the market for at least a year. Well, that's fine, but then basically you're saying you're going to let everybody else who's taken the drug be the experimental folks and wait to see what happens so you can decide whether to give it to your family. It's nice if you have that luxury, but lots of times you don't have that luxury.
Yeah. Well, it makes me also wonder just how difficult it is weighing the potential benefits with the potential downside. And if, for example, just if you look at the question of Avandia, they're a very large panel advising the FDA. They clearly had concerns about potential side effects and this increased risk of heart attack. At the same time, they did not tell the FDA, we think that you should withdraw the drug. Another case that I read about, this was a drug that's now that's being reviewed. It is an obesity drug, something called Kinexa, if that's even the way you pronounce it. Last month, an advisory committee to the FDA on a 10-6 vote recommended against approving the drug. And it was not a question of effectiveness, because apparently it works very well for that purpose, but they were very concerned about the side effects. So here's two cases where in one case, apparently an effective drug had problems. And so the committee said, no, we really don't think that this should go out. And another case where apparently an effective drug has problems. And here the committee said, well, we think on balance, yes, it has problems, but we think that the drug should remain available. How do you make that call?
Well, FDA is a couple of things. There are a whole bunch of things loaded up in your question and your statements, which are really good. I think the first thing to know is that in the United States, advisory panels are exactly that, advisory panels to the FDA. The advisory panel could vote, 10 to 0 against a drug, and the FDA can still go against the advisory panel's advice. So they always have that option. In the way our laws are structured, the advisory panels are not decision makers. They are clearly there for advice. The other thing is that, I'm not familiar with Kiniksa's story to the extent that you are, but I have some ideas about how it probably is going to take hold here. Mm-hmm. That there are concerns about safety, but obesity is a major problem in the United States. FDA is trying to deal with that problem, and by dealing with that problem and helping people with obesity avoid heart disease and diabetes and other really bad illnesses that are associated with diabetes, they would love to see something that's effective out there on the market to help these people. They, over the last 5 or 6 years, have been putting into place something called REMS, Risk Evaluation and Management Strategies. And basically, a REMS is something that goes beyond just saying, we can approve this drug, and then it goes out there, and anybody who wants to take it will take it. Now, I don't know whether they have a REMS for Kiniksa, but if they do, which they might, under the circumstances that you recommend, that you noted to me, they would have some protections in there for the patient. For example, it might be limited only to certain prescribers, or perhaps the manufacturer has to do additional studies after the drug's out on the market that are mandated, that aren't usually mandated for regular drugs that go out onto the market. Or they might have to establish a registry of patients who are taking the drug so they can follow them and note any problems that occur so they can take faster action on it. So there are varying degrees of restrictiveness that FDA can put into place with the drug now that, with which they really have some safety concerns, but which they also feel meets such a unmet medical need that there has to be something out there for these people who are suffering from a particular disease. And that's part of what goes into the benefit to risk equation, if you will, that when they're looking at the benefit, they're not looking at the 15th statin for lowering your cholesterol, but they're often looking at, well, they are looking at that, but if there's a drug that has some questionable safety issues, that 15th drug for lowering your cholesterol is probably not going to make it to the market. But if there are some other drugs for which there is a real need, in other words, there's nothing out there really effective to treat these illnesses, for example, like obesity. I mean, I know people can diet and things, but that's always been found to be difficult. Then they have more in their armamentarium now to try to assure the safety of these products.
Yeah. Well, one of the questions that I had was that if you take a look at the approval process, and it is a long process, and there are a number of steps where you go from the first point where a company has something that they think would both profit them and would benefit people. And so you go through various kinds of levels of studies where you do studies on animals in the laboratory, and then you progress to the point where people are actually taking it, and then larger numbers of people taking it, and you review all the way along. And I'm sure that there are a number of points in this process where drugs fall away, where from whatever reason something that you start with seems to be promising, and then you come to the point where you have to say, no, this isn't working. And I guess what I wonder, though, is are there many medicines that, say, make it all the way to the point of clinical trials where you're starting to have some significant number of people taking them, that when that is reviewed, that it gets all the way to that point and then, but the FDA says, no, we really don't think that the benefits here outweigh the disadvantages.
Absolutely. There are products for which that happens. I don't know the numbers, but certainly that does happen all the time, that a company will be in the midst of its phase three or final clinical trial, and safety signals will come up, and they're just going to have to abandon it. Mm-hmm. And FDA is not charged with making sure that a company doesn't lose money. FDA is charged with making sure the drugs are safe and effective. So FDA puts blinders on with regard to how much it might cost the manufacturer. At least they're supposed to. They're really looking at the public health. The good news is that a lot of drugs just go away right in the beginning. In phase one, there's just a very small number of subjects, and they're normal, healthy subjects who don't have any disease, and they're just looking at the drug itself to see whether it's going to cause any problems. And the reason they get normal, healthy people is that if there are any problems uncovered, the likelihood is higher that they're due to the drug than due to some other underlying illness or some other drugs that they're taking. And so a lot of times things will show up in phase one, and that'll be the end of it. And sometimes there's only maybe 60 people in a phase one study, so it's very, very small. If phase one works okay, they move into phase two, which might have several hundred people. And now they're starting to look for people who have the disease, and they're continuing to look at safety all the way through. And then if that looks like it's worked, then it moves into phase three, which could have a couple thousand patients in it, maybe up to 3,000 patients in a phase three trial. And that's where you give it to large numbers of people, and they have to monitor them periodically, regularly. They have to report on any adverse events that occur during that, and sometimes in that process, a drug will fail. I'm sure there's some data out there, and I don't have them, I'm afraid, as to what percent in phase one, phase two, phase three. But indeed, there are plenty of examples where that happens.
Just very quickly here, I'd like to reintroduce the guest for anybody who has just tuned in. Our guest is Frank Palumbo. He's professor and executive director at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy Center on Drugs and Public Policy. He's a member of the Maryland Bar. He is also a licensed pharmacist and has practiced both pharmacy and law. He's particularly interested in his academic work in pharmaceutical law and regulation, but also things like the economics of the prescription drug business and how drugs are developed. And we're talking here this morning about the whole process, how it is that the FDA takes a look at medications and tries to determine whether indeed they are safe and effective and it would be a good thing for them to be available to the public. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Given that, as you explained a little bit earlier, that at the point where medicines become generally available, that a relatively small number of people have taken them, it becomes very important for there to be post-approval monitoring of how people do when they take these medicines. And indeed, that is something that the FDA does. Can you talk about that? Just what does the FDA do after a drug is approved to try to keep track of how people who are taking it are doing?
Absolutely. And that is a big part of FDA's responsibility. It's known as phase four, but it really is just a term of art rather than an official term. The FDA gathers information from a variety of sources. First of all, the manufacturers themselves are required by law to report any adverse events reports that they receive, and they must report those to the FDA. In the first 2 years that a drug is out on the market, they have to be reported every 3 months, and after that, once a year. So there's a stream of information that comes in from the manufacturers themselves. Then there's something called the MedWatch system that FDA uses, and consumers can use the MedWatch system as well as any health professional. And it's available online. Just Google MedWatch and the form will come up. And basically that is a mechanism for health professionals of many kinds, as doctors, pharmacists, nurses, dentists, whoever, to report suspected adverse events to the FDA related to a particular drug. And it's also available to consumers to do the same. So FDA will evaluate every one of those MedWatch reports that comes in and code it and make a judgment as to whether there are associations between the drug and particular adverse events. They continually amass a database of these things through the post-market surveillance process. FDA has what they call the Adverse Events Reporting System, or AERS, and all these MedWatch reports and all the reports from the manufacturers go into the AERS system to amass the database on this post-market use of the drugs. Then FDA also has to figure out, okay, well, what are the odds of this happening? You know, it's okay to have the numerator, but you need a denominator as well. And so what they do is they collect information from pharmacy benefit management companies, from other payers of prescription drugs, from pharmacies themselves with no patient identifying information. And they look at, and I get a lot of this from contractors who pull this data together for them. They then have a denominator, so they can say, well, okay, we have so many mentions of this particular adverse event, but here are all the exposures to that drug, all the prescriptions that were filled for that drug, or all the patients who have taken that drug over the period of time we're looking at. Now, I wish I could say it's a perfect system, but it's not. I often tell people there's only two things wrong with this, what I was talking to you about, and those two things are the numerator and the denominator. because the numerator probably being the worst today, because the system relies on voluntary reporting, and so you don't know, you know, to what extent everything that is seen out there is reported, and it's very frustrating because those of us who would like to have a better handle on this have to live with what's out there. The only required reporting is in hospitals. If they do see an adverse event, they're required by the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations to report it as a condition of their continuing accreditation. So they do report. But out there in the community where we have 95% of the patients on any given day, reporting is probably not all that consistent. And think about it. You go to your doctor. You get a pill for cholesterol, and your doctor, you experience some muscle weakness, and you call your doctor, and he says, "Stop taking it. I'm going to give you another prescription." So the doctor gives you another prescription, and you take that into the pharmacy, and the pharmacist says, "Well, don't take that first one because it's going to be replaced with this new one that I'm giving you." So a pharmacist fills the new prescription, which the doctor wrote, and out the door you go with your new prescription. Well, the odds are really, really high that nobody has reported anything to FDA in that situation because, you know, the doctor's busy, the pharmacist is busy, they're satisfied that the patient's been taken care of, that their problem has been dealt with, and they've both done their jobs as far as the patient is concerned, which is the most important thing to them, and so there no report goes in, and this is I would think a common scenario.
We're just about at our midpoint here, and again, questions are certainly welcome for our guest, Professor Frank Palumbo, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to just maybe shift a little bit to a slightly different topic, but this is, in fact, the thing that caught our eye and got us thinking once again about revisiting this topic, which we have discussed before, and this was when we read a story about the problem of unapproved drugs being available here in the United States. And apparently there are significant numbers of prescription drugs that are on the market that are not approved by FDA. And apparently this is also not a new problem. And when we saw this, we sort of started scratching our heads and said, well, wait a minute, what do you mean unapproved drugs on the market? How can such a thing even be?
Well, that's a really good question. Actually, there are a couple of things that I would like to maybe talk about with regard to that. The first is the absolute term that you talked about, unapproved drugs. When Congress passed the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act back in 1938, Congress said that all drugs have to be safe to be on the market. It was only in 1962 that Congress then amended the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act to say that drugs have to be safe and effective to be on the market. And what they did was they went back and they grandfathered anything that had been on the market prior to 1938. So they said if a drug has been on the market prior to 1938, it really doesn't have to be proved effective. It just has to be safe. And so those are what we call the grandfather drugs, as the name implies. And those drugs never went through FDA approval, and yet they're on the market. And so there are a number of those out on the market today that are safe but have not gone through the approval process. And as an example, aspirin. Aspirin's been on the market for a long time. So aspirin for taking a headache, you know, for pain as an analgesic, is a drug that has been on the market forever. It was certainly on the market prior to 1938 and didn't have to get FDA approval, nor did the manufacturer of aspirin ever have to do any studies to determine that it's effective, although I think we all know it is. Now, looking at aspirin, though, for preventing heart disease or strokes in low-dose aspirin, that's a new indication. So that would have had to go and get FDA approval for that indication. So now we have two bottles of aspirin on the pharmacy shelf. One of them is the old aspirin for just a headache. The other one is this new low-dose aspirin for preventing heart disease or heart attacks and strokes. And they have two different regulatory statuses or stati in that the approval of the labeling for the heart attack or stroke would have had to get FDA approval because it came much later than 1938, but the old labeling did not, so that's still on the market. There are other drugs. Synthroid for thyroid has been one of those drugs, but although FDA has now for some time required manufacturers of Synthroid to come in and get approval because there were problems with that drug, and FDA finally said, you know, with that one, you're going to have to get approval. And FDA is moving towards, they've done this with other drugs that were on the market prior to 1938 as well, and they're doing it through regulation, saying, you know, if you want to keep your drug on the market, you're just going to have to do some studies, and you're going to have to, you know, demonstrate to us that it's effective, or we're going to take action against this drug. So they are actually doing that, but this is a very lengthy process. But there's also, in addition to these unapproved drugs, there's also a bigger issue, actually, the issue of unapproved uses of prescription drugs. So when a drug gets marketed, or approved for marketing, it gets approved for marketing for a particular indication. So drug X is approved for treating hypertension, and that's what that FDA, that's what the studies were done on for hypertension. That's what FDA said the drug is approved for. But once it's out on the market, then doctors may find that it's that they're using it for something else. Maybe they're using it for angina. You know, people who have trouble getting enough oxygen to their heart, and yet it's not approved for that. And if you look in medical journals, you always see case studies of drugs that are approved for one thing that look like they are going to be useful for something else because a physician has tried it for that and it seems to work, and so these uses are unapproved, and there is no legal prohibition against a physician prescribing it for an unapproved use or a pharmacist dispensing it for that unapproved use. The only prohibition is on the company. The manufacturer is unable to market it for that unapproved use. If they want to market the drug for that use, and that includes the detail person going into the doctor's office and talking about it, if they want to do that, they have to go back to FDA, do the clinical trials to show that it's effective for that other indication as well. There's probably more of a problem, if you will, with unapproved uses of approved drugs than there is with unapproved drugs out there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I have a caller here, and I'd like to bring them in as someone who is in Champaign on our line number one. Let's talk with them. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Well, the example that you gave of a cholesterol drug that causes muscle weakness and everything sort of rang a bell with me, because that's exactly what happened to me. And I can tell you why that wouldn't get reported, at least from my doctor, because he told me I was crazy and it was in my head, and what I really had was fibromyalgia. And I knew he was wrong. I stopped taking the drug, and the muscle pain and weakness went away. But, you know, when doctors don't believe you when you say you have a side effect, obviously a side effect isn't going to get reported. And I just wanted to make that comment, and you can discuss it, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Well, oh, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. I think that's a really good comment, because I seriously doubt she's alone in it. In fact, I think she probably has a lot of company with in folks who believe that something they're taking is causing a particular side effect, and their doctor doesn't agree with them. What I can suggest is that you as a consumer have the ability to report it to FDA. It's your suspicion. Maybe you can't prove it, but you might have some really good case for telling the FDA that, I had this problem right after I started taking the drug. I stopped taking the drug. It went away. My doctor didn't believe me. That doesn't mean you didn't have the problem. All it means is that your doctor didn't believe you, for whatever that's worth. So I would suggest in those situations that you do have a little bit of an option here, and that is to report it directly to FDA as the patient. You can certainly do that.
Something else that I wanted to get your thoughts on, I don't mean to be being critical of doctors here, particularly because there are so many medicines now that are out there, and new ones come along all the time. But having said that, clearly there are some people who will not tolerate some drugs. So there
Absolutely.
Are some people who can't take certain things. And then there are also will be people who, for reasons of their pre-existing conditions, their medical history and so forth, drugs are going to be contraindicated. That is, they just shouldn't take them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for a physician who's making the prescribing decision, to know that, you've got to know about the medicine, you've got to know about the contraindications, you got to know about potential side effects, and then you have to have a good medical history from your patient, which may or may not be able or willing to provide. All of that makes me think, well, when it comes time for the doctor to make the prescribing decision, does he or she really have all the information that they should about the medicine and about the patient so that they can try as best they can to avoid problems?
Sure. Certainly don't want to engage in doctor bashing either. I think that when you look at what doctors have to go through to prescribe a drug, that there are certain things that they should be doing. Are they all doing them? I don't know. What percentages of them are doing this and so forth. First of all, they do need information. They do need to take your medical history into account, and they do need to realize what the contraindications are and the fact that drugs might act differently on different patients. That's a given across pretty much all drugs. I think a physician would be foolish to prescribe a drug that he or she was not familiar with. I mean, certainly they have the legal authority to write that prescription, and someone, and they take it to the pharmacy, and the pharmacist doesn't know whether the physician knows a lot about that drug or not, and fills the prescription the patient takes it. So hopefully the physician has familiarized himself or herself with this. The labeling is there. It's all in the PDR. It's available online. Physicians might have to hunt for it, unfortunately. But there is information out there, especially on things like contraindications and warnings, and even with the more serious adverse events, FDA uses what they call a box warning. So a physician picks up the labeling. There's a big boxed-in area with the really important side effects or contraindications highlighted. So that's the very first thing that the physician will see before they read down the list. All of that is available. A physician needs to take advantage of that. I could see, though, that there are some times when that might not be available to the physician. For example, it's after hours, and you call the answering service, and the physician is at home, and he picks up the phone and talks to the patient and, you know, hopefully asks them a few questions about their medical history, but doesn't have their record there and prescribes based on the information that he or she gets from the patient over the phone and any personal knowledge they may or may have on the patient, but, you know, they may not either. This might be a patient that saw them 6 months ago, and in the meantime they've seen 60 gazillion patients and they just don't remember, you know, that individual's case. So I think some of it is situational. Certainly if a physician fails to heed the information, though, that's in the labeling, that cuts across all patients. And that certainly is something that I would recommend against, and I believe physicians would recommend against as well. One other point. For the most part, physicians have a relatively small basket of drugs that they prescribe. They're drugs that they're well familiar with and they use a lot. And so of the thousands of drug products that are out there, you know, physician X might use 30 of them in his practice or her practice for the most part. And so you're not really dealing with a physician who's got to remember everything about 1,000 drugs, but basically everything about the small number of drugs that he or she usually uses. And then if they're going to move outside of that, they certainly have the information at hand to be able to do that.
About 10 minutes left, so a little bit more in this part of Focus. Our guest is Frank Palumbo. He's professor and executive director at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy Center on Drugs and Public Policy. And we're talking here about something about the mechanism that the government uses to try to determine safety and effectiveness of prescription drugs and some of the problems that are connected with that. So we have a caller here ready to go. And others, if you'd like to jump in, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller in Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Yes. Yes.
Hey, my question is this. There's this constant advertising now of new drugs directly to consumers, and I guess might have invited some law change because it seemed like it changed at one period where we didn't really see that much of it, and, you know, the long list of disclaimers and all that stuff on. I'm just wondering, does that have an effect by pushing consumers to go question their doctors? Does that have any effect on this whole mechanism?
Oh, I that's a good question, and I certainly believe that it does. We're really in desperate need of some good, well-done research to be able to demonstrate exactly how much of an effect it has. But I can tell you this, that I've talked to people at manufacturers, and they say, you know, when we don't prescribe our drug or directly advertise our drug, prescribing is down at this level. If we put the direct-to-consumer ads out, it goes way up like this. They're kind of raising their arms up and down. And They can see for themselves in their own sales how they change dramatically when they do put the direct to consumer advertising into effect. So I think from that standpoint it absolutely has an effect on sales of the drug, and you'd have to draw your own inferences from that. But I think certainly that they're hoping to draw in new patients for their drug who have not been taking any drugs in that category before, and then also to maybe move some patients from other drugs for that particular illness that their drug treats over to their product. Now, the safeguard in all of this is the doctor, because even though the drugs are advertised directly to consumers, the consumers can't buy them directly. They have to ask their doctor to prescribe them, and their doctor has to agree to prescribe them. And if the doctor doesn't feel it's in the consumer's best interest or the patient's best interest, the doctor is not going to prescribe it. But oftentimes the doctor will say, well, you know, this isn't much different from what you're already taking, but if you want to try it out, you know, we can go ahead and try out on it and see how that works. Direct-to-consumer ads come in other varieties as well. For example, there are health help-seeking ads. So, for example, you might see an ad that describes a person who, you know, doesn't want to get up in the morning, doesn't have an appetite, doesn't really want to talk to anybody, is sad all the time, and so on and so forth. And, you know, basically the help-seeking ad would say, well, perhaps you're suffering from depression, and you should go and see your doctor. And it might be sponsored by the drug company, but there's no mention of any drug name, but the company's name might be on the ad. In which case, the consumer hopefully would at least go to see the doctor and get prescribed for them whatever they might need. The ones that are more effective in changing things are the ones that are drug specific, and those are pretty glitzy, high powered commercials that are designed to influence consumers to put pressure on their doctors to prescribe the drugs for them. The FDA has actually as of about 2 years ago, a law was passed called the FDA Amendments Act, FDA, and I kind of remember the exact year, but it's only about 2 years old. And that law has put additional teeth into the requirements for direct-to-consumer ads. So they now have to be a little bit slower. They have to have more information on them, on the side effects, than they used to have. Because, you know, you may have noticed that in most of these ads, they talk about all the good stuff, and then at the very end, you know, this can do this to you, that to you, and the other thing to you, and so forth. And it seemed like it was somewhat unbalanced, which in many cases it probably was. So they're really, really pushing more on this how this information is going to be distributed within these ads so that the consumers get more information on the side effects. Nothing's perfect in this area, and it certainly is a departure from what used to be prior to 1997 when the FDA put out some draft guidelines and then finalized them in 1999. Before then, we really didn't have any direct-to-consumer ads to any degree because they had to have all that what's called brief information with them, which is the stuff when you're looking in a journal and you look at the one page of the ad, you turn the page, you see all the fine print. Well, that was required even if you were going to broadcast it until 1997, and then that's when everything just really, really took off. So FDA is very concerned about making sure that this works well, that the consumers are getting the information they need to get, and of course there's always the safeguard of the doctors having to prescribe the drug.
All right. I hope that gets to the question in the caller. I think it's a very good one, and it was an area that I wanted us to get into in the conversation. And I was thinking about a report that we had on our air earlier this week. It was something that was done at National Public Radio about some problems associated with one of the newer formulations of oral contraceptive, one of those that's now designed for women to take it on a longer-term basis in the way that instead of having a period every month, they maybe have three or four periods a year.
Mm-hmm.
And what I thought was interesting about the report was that I think it raised so many questions having to do with the very issues that we're talking about here.
Yes.
And one of the things that they were looking at was the fact that in the way that the drug is marketed to consumers, there are a number of benefits that the manufacturer suggests. There's certainly the primary benefit, which is birth control. Mm-hmm. But in addition, they talk about things that it can help with menstrual irregularities, can help with premenstrual syndrome, mm-hmm. Can even help with serious acne. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that a lot of physicians would say, well, yes, in some patients, that those things do happen. But it seemed the larger concern was, well, how many different things can you say about a drug in terms of its benefits, and what do you have to do to back that claim up? And are drug manufacturers making claims that are questionable or can't really even be justified?
Right. Well, I mean, this is an excellent question, and it's loaded with a couple of things. First of all, you know, there are a few of these longer term drugs out, you know, where you take them less frequently, and of course, one of the things that I particularly find missing from these ads for these drugs is that, you know, what do you do if you have a problem with them? Because that's unclear to a lot of people. They say, if you call your doctor if you have a problem. Well, the doctor says, geez, you know, I gave you this thing. It's going to be in your system for a whole month. You know, it's not like you stop taking the drug that's going to be out of your system in 4 to 12 hours, but this isn't going to be out of your system for a month or whatever it is. So those are issues that I think need to be dealt with direct-to-consumer ads, those kinds of things. The other thing is, though, to answer your question directly, when you're dealing with other indications like acne, PMS, those are known as disease claims. So if they have that in their ads, in addition to the oral contraception, they would have had to go through the clinical trials and present FDA with the data to show that their drug was also good for treating acne, PMS, or I think you might have mentioned some other thing as well. Mm-hmm. And so they can't just say it. They cannot just say it. If they said it and they hadn't gone through the trials, their drug would be deemed misbranded and they would be in big trouble with the government over this. So when you see these things, they will have gone through the FDA or they're out there illegally.
All right. Let's go to another caller. And this will be, I believe, somebody who is on our toll-free line, our line number 4. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed, I think, one word. It's a very interesting program, are. But you mentioned a thyroid medication going back for retesting. And which one is that, did you say?
Well, actually, that was levothyroxine.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you. Very interesting.
All right. Very good. I'm glad we can answer the question. And again, we have a couple of minutes left here, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk at illinois.edu. We're coming down to the point that we just have a couple of minutes left. Now, obviously, this is quite a complicated area, but I guess that I find myself coming back to this question of do people really have, what sort of access do they have to information about the medications that they're taking in a way that your average person who is not a pharmacist or a physician or a chemist can actually understand?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a number of good question. A number of places where consumers have access to information. I think the first and one that a lot of people ignore is that when they go to their pharmacy to get a prescription drug, they will get and I do not know a pharmacy that doesn't do that. That's a pretty broad statement, but they will get, in addition to their prescription, they'll get a leaflet that was printed out specifically for their particular drug. And they need to read that. Mm-hmm. They need to read that leaflet and see what it says about the drugs, what it's used for, what the side effects are, any particular things they need to look for, or labeling or storage or anything like that. That's really important. That would be the first line to me. Pharmacies even provide that with refills. And I think a lot of people just throw them away and they just go right for the drug. But that information is right there, right under their nose, and they need to read it. The other is, of course, they can go to the manufacturer's website, and they can look up the labeling. That's right there. If it's a generic drug, they might be a little more troublesome. They need to maybe Google the drug and try to find out if they can find anything on the labeling. They can certainly go into FDA's website at fda.gov, G-O-V, and they can search for the drug in FDA's website to see what FDA has said about it. There is a search box in that website. So there are a lot of different ways that they can access information about the drugs they are taking. But as I said, I think the best place to start is when they pick the drug up from the pharmacy to open up that leaflet that comes with it and read it.
We'll try real quick to get one more caller here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm taking about 17 different drugs, mostly for things like depression, anxiety, fibromyalgia, chronic pain. All of my doctors, my many doctors, seem to agree that this is an appropriate plan. I'm experiencing side effects. They don't want to change.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried multiple doctors. They don't want to seem to change me. Now, I have this conviction that, you know, these drugs are causing bad side effects and even actually causing some of the problems that I'm suffering from. Mm-hmm. What do I do?
Well, can I just ask, how many doctors are you seeing?
Many doctors, probably eight different, you know, six to eight different doctors in different professions who I think are credible
mm-hmm.
and good at what they do.
Well, my first standard response to you, I think, would be to make sure that your family doctor, that you have one doctor who's kind of the repository for all of this information, and that you go to that family doctor and that family doctor will communicate with the others actually on your behalf. They sort of act as a gatekeeper on your behalf. That's one thing. The second thing is, I don't know whether you do this, but you should get your drugs, especially in your case with so many, from one pharmacy. Do you do that?
I'm going to have to jump in here and try to get us to wrap up, and I really apologize to both you and the caller, but I take the point because what you're saying is that way you have also somebody, if you're working in the same pharmacy, who's checking for possible drug interactions.
And knows what's coming in from all the different doctors, too.
And
can look at duplications and other things.
Well, I apologize to you, Frank, and also to the caller. I'm simply going to have to say we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. Mm-hmm. Our guest is Francis Palumbo. He's professor, executive director, University of Maryland School of Pharmacy, Center on Drugs and Public Policy. And we certainly appreciate you giving some of your time today. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.